Meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have four bills on the agenda. I think a lot of them are not going to take a lot of time, and so maybe we'll go fast. Senator Pappas, the Dula bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you recall, members may recall, we did pass this bill last year, and it did get hung up in conference committee. It was also passed by the House, but ultimately it never did get to the governor's desk, or else he vetoed it. He vetoed it. That's what happened. But it was part. It was a package. It was rolled into a bigger package, and he vetoed it for other reasons that were in the package, not for this bill. I do have an author's amendment. It says A09-0022, and this is to put the bill in the shape that it passed in the other body, which is fine with us.
Senator Coring moves the A09-022 amendment. Mm-hmm. Put the bill in shape the author wants. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, what we did in the bill is we took out Section 1, and which is going to be pursued in other legislation at a later date. And in Section 2, we took out the, on page 1, line 21, any additional organizations recognized by the Commissioner of Health, because the Commissioner of Health did not want to do this because it involves work and staff time and money. So we felt the important thing was to add the International Center for Traditional Childbirthing. We could let the rest of that go. I think that was the change that we made. And, Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, I'll just let my testifiers talk about the importance of this bill since we've heard it before. Susan, did you want to start?
These are just really housekeeping amendments.
Ms. Lane, could you identify yourself for the record?
I'm Susan Lane. I am a member of the Minnesota Better Birth Coalition, and I am a doula and a childbirth educator and a lactation counselor. Continuous support it's just a word that wasn't in there before, but it is a defining word of doula care, that it is continuous support unlike any other care that women get. Maternity care, it is one person who remains with them through labor and birth, and that is sort of one of the defining qualities, and that's what contributes to the good outcomes that doulas get. And I have cited on a sheet that you have in front of you, the most recent support for that comes from the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Doula care is essentially no longer a controversial topic as it was 6 years ago. Everybody supports it now, and it's working very well. So that is that piece. And then the other piece is that there is another agency, and I should maybe let Akmiri speak to that, that is training doulas in our community and across the country, and we wanted to be sure that they are, that doulas trained by the International Center for Traditional Childbearing are eligible to be on the registry that was established.
Good afternoon. My name is Akmiri Sakara, and I'm the chairperson for the Minnesota chapter of the International Center for Traditional Childbearing. And our organization has been here for about 3 years. It's originally out of Portland, Oregon. We here are really trying to look at infant mortality in the African and African-American community in this area, the state. And so really trying to help women be able to have the kind of births that they want to have and have the kind of support, because a lot of people don't have the support just because they've moved away from family. And so we act as that, and so we're full circle. And so we work with people from the beginning and through postpartum.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to speak with concerns about the bill? If not, Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate File 401 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson Ropes. Senate File 213.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. We're here to present Senate File 213, and I have an A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment is to put the bill in the shape you want. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. We're here today to talk about adding organic products onto the list of foods that are allowed for the Women, Infants, and Children program. And as usual, I get a hold of all the stakeholders that might be involved with a particular issue. And I have at the table with me Maggie Dybel, who's with the Minnesota Department of Health. She's a director of Community and Family Health. And also Tom Peterson, representing the farmers with the Minnesota Farmers Union. And I was very happy to find out that the department has been working on identifying lists of organic foods that are cost neutral and might be added to the WIC program anyway. So it was a perfect dovetailing of initiatives, it seems. And Maggie can tell you a little bit more about what they're looking at. So we put this bill before you, and it seems like all players are in agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Maggie Dybel. I'm the director of the Community and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. Recently, USDA initiated some changes to the WIC food package to expand the package to include a healthier variety of foods, including whole grains and fresh fruits and vegetables. And we have been preparing to implement that new package beginning in September of this year. In that process, we were looking at the possibility of including organic foods. As you may be aware, organic foods generally are more expensive than other foods. We did some estimates of what the cost of that might be, and I'm not sure if the committee has been given this table, but I have a table to estimate that the food package with non-organic foods would be $40.02, and the average cost of this package with organic foods would be $61.77, or a difference of $21.75. And using an estimate of approximately 15% of the population that would purchase organic foods, and this is based on numbers of participants in another state's program that did initiate this organic food package but no longer does this, 15% of their population purchased that. We estimate that we could serve almost 9,000 fewer participants if we were to include all organic products. We have surveyed the market out there and determined that there are some products that we can include in the package that would render the package cost neutral. These include organic baby foods, bulk dried beans, oatmeal and brown rice, tofu, and some soy beverages. In addition, we're going to be issuing cash value vouchers that will allow participants to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables up to, we haven't determined the actual price level of that, but if it were $6, for example, participants could choose to purchase organic fruits and vegetables. Included in that package will also be, in addition to fresh, frozen and canned vegetables as well.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you.
Just to clarify, if we went to a full organics, I think is the price increase that Ms. Dybel was talking about. We're not going to all organics, such as organic milk and organic cheese, because it's too expensive at this point. So we're only talking about cost-neutral additions right now, so it should be a cost-neutral policy before you.
Ms. Dybel, I'm curious about the language here, notwithstanding federal requirements or laws. We can't really set them aside. What are the I don't know why somebody's saying that here, because we can't really ignore federal laws. Do they have standards that...
The USDA that administers the WIC program provides guidance as to the content of the food package.
And what do they say about this?
For foods that are allowable within the package, for example, it specifies a certain amount of milk or cheese products that a participant can get with their vouchers, that the states are responsible for covering the cost of those products.
So I was just saying, is this contrary to federal law, though? It's not contrary.
No, it's not.
I don't know why we need...
Mr. Chair, I think we added that in there just in case Minnesota would decide to add organic beet potato chips or, you know, something like that that is out of compliance with the federal identified foods that are acceptable within the WIC program. So we want to keep in mind all the time that this is a federal program, and while Minnesota is going to add cost-neutral organics, there are certain organic foods that we would not be able to add to this list because they would be we'd be out of compliance with the federal.
Which means we don't, Senator Erickson, which my point is we don't need to say that. If we're out of compliance with federal law, we can't do it.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Why I'm saying I don't think we need the language, but I'll talk with Senate Counsel about that.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. We're here to speak in favor of Senate File 213 and appreciate the changes Senator Erickson Ropes has worked on. I've worked on this piece of legislation for over 5 years, I think, and I think the time has come, and appreciate the amendment she's offered. And I work in the organic sector quite a bit. I also do chair the State Organic Advisory Task Force that advises the Commissioner of Agriculture on organic policies. And while I'm not testifying in that role today, I can tell you it's public record that is one of the, this legislation is one of the recommendations that the task force has made the last two legislative sessions. And that task force is made up of industry, farmers, buyers, retailers, processors, university, that we go down this road. And so I do appreciate that, your consideration. I also would just note for the committee that the organic sector in Minnesota continues to grow. The latest survey shows that there are over 700 farms producing organic crops and over 200 or nearly 200 certified processors, and the value of organic production in Minnesota is estimated at $40 million. And so I urge your consideration of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is it Ms. Deval?
Deeble,
I'm sorry. Can you tell me, when I heard your testimony, it sounds like the department is already doing what this law is asking you to do. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senator, we are moving to incorporate organic products into the expanded WIC food package, yes.
And so, Mr. Chairman, what does this law do for you that you can't do right now? I mean, the question I'm asking is, it sounds like in your testimony you said that over a period of time and you were looking at this issue and dealing with the federal regulations that we have to operate within, and you have in the department been looking at organic foods that would fit into this package, and you've been putting them in the package. And this is a law saying we're going to do that. And I'm just confused about, if you're already doing it, why do we need to pass a law to give you permission to do what you're already doing?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I will defer to Senator Erickson Ropes on this.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Senator Hand. As you know, the department could change its mind next week or next month. Things change. So I think this is a really important initiative for Minnesota farmers. It's a good initiative for recipients of the WIC program, and it's worth putting into statute that we do make a movement towards including organics. It is the practice of the department at the moment, but as you know, the department can do whatever the department wants to do.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Senator Erickson, so are we saying then that we're going to write law to cover things that previously were governed by rules that departments operated under, and we're in effect taking away some of their rulemaking authority by passing a law here? Is that the effect of this? Is that, I mean, I'm a little confused. I agree with you. If this is something that the department has discretion to do and they choose to do it, which apparently they are and have been for some time, and I guess, yes, it's possible they would choose not to do it, but and maybe if the intent is to prevent them, maybe we should wait till they say they're not going to do it before we pass the law. I guess I'm just confused.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, the other thing that this bill does is it requires them to regularly reevaluate the list and continue to add products, you know, as the prices change, and the market changes all the time, as you know. So we want to make sure that we're keeping this program front and center in the department's agenda.
Senator Bergen.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. DeVall, would the department be asking for any more staff as a result of this bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, no.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, you said that $40 million a year in Minnesota is organic right now?
Mm-hmm.
And you said it's how fast is that growing? Is that like?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the growth we've always quoted is 20%. Slowed down a little bit in this economy. I visited with several retailers today also, and they told me, oddly enough, that the demand for organic sales is strong at the co-op level, but slowed down some at like a chain type store, but it's still increasing. The one area they did say, and I was glad to hear the department say this, they've seen a huge increase, 25% increase this year alone in bulk sales, so items that are bigger than the usual packaged item, and that was one of the suggestions of the retailers that the department could look at as a bulk sale type item being compatible in price and not costing. So,
when people buy organic, how much of their organic is produced in Minnesota? Is it higher percentage than of other food products?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that, but I do know that we rank among the top states in items such as soybeans and other type products. We're fifth in the nation in production, in organic production, so we have a very robust organic sector in Minnesota.
Other questions from the committee or discussion? Anybody else in the audience want to speak to this bill? Senator Erickson Ropes, would you mind deleting the first clause, notwithstanding federal requirements or laws, comma? Because we can't do that anyway. So.
Yes, so well, then I'll be happy to withdraw.
Senator Erickson Ropes moves to delete everything on line 1.4 up through the comma. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Including the comma.
Including the comma.
Yes.
Including the comma. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill. Does this go anywhere else or straight to the floor or? Straight to the floor. We've had no requests. Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate File 213 as amended be recommended to pass. On that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund, should we start with your acupuncture bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Senate file 245 is a bill that will allow licensed acupuncture practitioners to be able to have direct referrals to them from health plans and other insurance companies. The licensed acupuncture practitioner has as much education as a chiropractor would have, and we feel that they are fully capable of being able to receive patients directly rather than through other practitioners. And there is evidence of better outcomes for acupuncture in regard to back pain than other modalities of treatment, for example, surgery, better outcomes and better patient satisfaction. And so those are some of the reasons why we're bringing this bill before you today. The bill is being named in honor of Edith R. Davis. She was a constituent of mine, and she founded the acupuncture program at the Northwestern Health Sciences College, and she died this year. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think we should go ahead and take the testimony on the bill.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Ms. Fritz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Kimberly Fritz, and I am the president of the Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine Association of Minnesota. The Equal Access to Acupuncture Bill is really a consumer interested bill. It is our feeling that at this point, although the consumer's health care policy may cover acupuncture, they don't have equal access to the expertise of a licensed acupuncturist. Most of the health care policies that cover acupuncture at this time require the patient to receive their acupuncture care from a medical doctor or a doctor of chiropractic, and yet excludes your licensed acupuncturist, which, as Senator Berglund pointed out, is highly qualified with a master's level of training in the field of acupuncture. We think it's a disservice to the community that the patients aren't able to have this coverage and seek out the expertise of licensed acupuncturists. I would equate it similarly to my insurance will allow me to take my child to a family practitioner, but I also have the choice to seek out the expertise of a pediatrician. And that's really where we're coming from, is we devote all of our time and study to the field of acupuncture, and it's in the best interest of the patient that they have access to that care.
And Ms. Fritz, the health plans and others will tend to, they may have somebody who provides acupuncture on their staff, and they'll refer to them but not to independent practitioners. Is that the issue? Or
a lot of times the patient doesn't need a referral for acupuncture, but it is clause to that the acupuncture must come from a medical doctor or a doctor of chiropractic, so thus excluding your licensed acupuncturist.
Questions from the committee? If not, Charles Sawyer, is Mr. Sawyer, Dr. Sawyer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Charles Sawyer. I'm the Senior Vice President and past Provost at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. I'm also a chiropractic doctor. Northwestern is a regionally accredited academic and federally funded research institution that trains acupuncturists, chiropractic doctors, and massage therapists. We also provide fee-based health services, including acupuncture and oriental medicine, in university-owned clinics located in Bloomington, Burnsville, and at the Woodwinds Hospital campus in Woodbury, as well as free services at Pillsbury House and the Minneapolis Salvation Army Harbor Light Center in Minneapolis. We also have clinical affiliations with Health East, the Benedictine Health System, Courage Center, Minnesota Oncology and Hematology, Regions, and Abbott Northwestern Hospitals, and Volunteers of America. I'm also here today to speak in support of Senate File 245, which, if passed and enacted into law, will eliminate a discriminatory inequity that currently inhibits licensed acupuncturists from receiving insurance reimbursement otherwise available to medical physicians and others who also use acupuncture in their practices. Without this legislation, patients will continue to be denied full access to licensed acupuncturists. Practitioners who have first professional master's degrees and commonly provide care for a broad range of health problems. This care is affordable, it's very rarely associated with complications, and clinically effective for many patients. Patients looking for help with conditions unsuccessfully addressed by conventional medical or other care are turning to acupuncturists, and the treatment they skillfully provide is increasingly being supported by the scientific literature. As an example, a randomized clinical trial conducted at the University of Maryland and published by the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2004 reported that patients suffering from arthritis of the knee receiving acupuncture experienced a reduction in pain and functional impairment. Other scientific studies exploring the benefits of acupuncture are currently being conducted at our institution in Bloomington and elsewhere, particularly large research universities. The acupuncture and oriental medicine professions are also growing as a result of increasing patient utilization and satisfaction, state licensure, a national certification agency, and a federally recognized accreditation organization. As a former chief academic officer at our institution, I can personally attest to the rigorous education our students receive, the quality of our faculty, and the breadth and depth of their clinical skills. For example, our curriculum consists of between 23 and 3,000 hours of graduate-level instruction, culminating in a comprehensive examination administered by the National Certification Commission for Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. Many consumers are currently paying for an acupuncture benefit in their insurance plans, and acupuncturists can be increasingly found providing care in hospitals and integrated medicine clinics. For example, in a collaborative relationship with Woodwinds Hospital here in the Twin Cities, licensed acupuncturists from our institution are seeing patients prior to and following surgery. Reductions in pain duration and intensity, as well as medication use, are examples of the favorable outcomes we and the hospital staff have observed since this service was established over a year ago. Across the country, acupuncturists are practicing in other healthcare systems, including Stanford University Medical Center, the Cleveland Clinic, Oregon Health and Science University, University of Maryland, Duke University, and George Washington University. A November 2008 solicitation from the Veterans Administration San Diego Healthcare System for acupuncturists to provide services to VA beneficiaries is also noteworthy. Senate File 245 is a consumer-minded bill that will level the reimbursement playing field and improve consumer access to a very patient-centered form of primary health care. Licensed acupuncturists in Minnesota fall under the oversight of the Board of Medical Practice, and yet, ironically, most health plans in the state do not provide reimbursement for acupuncture services unless provided by medical or osteopathic physicians. This is unfair to patients who should be able to see the provider of their choice and runs counter to a health care reform principle that all clinicians should be able to practice to the full extent of their training and licensure. I urge you to rectify an unfair and unnecessary inequity by passing this bill out of your committee and further supporting it as it moves through the legislative process. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sawyer. Questions from the committee? If not, thank you. We have Phil Griffin wanted to speak in opposition to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm a lobbyist. I represent two health plans here in Minnesota, both Preferred One and UCare, but today I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The Minnesota Council of Health Plans is opposed to the passage of Senate File 245. For many years, I've testified before this committee on licensure bills, and I've told this committee that after the passage of a licensure bill, you will most likely see a bill for mandated coverage by those providers later on. This bill is an example of that trend. The bill expands the number of providers that a health plan will be required to contract with. This will lead to an increase in utilization, which is the point of the bill. The bill also eliminates some of the practices of oversight that we have over practitioners by using physicians to oversee these types of procedures. As plans, employers, legislators, and individuals, we hear on a daily basis that the cost of health care is already too expensive. We should not be talking this session about expanding access to more providers at a time when we need to make sure that coverage is kept affordable for as many people as possible. Plans do pay for pain management by acupuncture. This bill would require plans to pay for every service and every procedure under the license scope of practice of an acupuncturist. Finally, we do not agree with what Dr. Sawyer has given you, that there is evidence-based medicine that shows that scientific studies proving efficacy of this procedure over others, and we would urge you to oppose the legislation. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, if there are questions, we'd be happy to take them at this time.
Thank you. Questions from the committee for Mr. Griffin? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe for Senator Berglund. I guess I'd be curious to know, Mr. Griffin just made the point that passing this would add to the cost of health care to people in Minnesota, and just if you believe that's the case or not, and if you would have a response to that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I believe that there are procedures where this is the lowest cost, best alternative available. I just did cite the study that was done in Great Britain. I would refer Mr. Griffith to the same study that shows that there is better outcomes and greater patient satisfaction with acupuncture for back pain than many patients experience when they are referred for surgery. And obviously, acupuncture is a lower cost alternative than surgery would be.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, I would tend to agree with you. I think that if that was the choice between doing surgery and doing this, I think you're right. My question, though, is more one of the system. And if we expand the coverage or the requirement, does that add additional cost where people then are paying for, through insurance premiums, a larger number of procedures that previously were not being required to be paid for? And it does this directionally add larger cost to the whole system, even though in selected instances it might be preferable to surgery? And I guess my understanding is those things still could be done today without the change in the law. But I'm just trying to get clarity on that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, today, if you want to see an acupuncturist, you have to go through a chiropractor who happens to have an acupuncturist on their staff. So it only stands to reason that if you have to go through a chiropractor to get the services of an acupuncturist, you're paying something to the chiropractor for accessing that service. So I don't believe there are things that acupuncturists are treating that are not treated in other ways that are as costly or more costly than an acupuncturist would be charging. And obviously, the bill doesn't do anything in regard to the fee schedules that might be approved by the HMOs for this type of service.
And then, Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, so just to be clear, your point is that by doing this, it would reduce the cost of health care to people in Minnesota. Is that your point?
Mr. Chairman, I believe in some cases it would reduce the cost. In other cases, it would just be a matter of choice of the consumer. It wouldn't cost any more than a substitute service might cost.
Further questions from members of the committee? Sarah Berglund, I'm wondering, paragraph one, if you would mind if we amended and took that out of statute and put it in session law and uncodified language instead? We don't normally, as far as I know, name once in a while we do, but we could still keep the name but put it in uncodified language.
That would be fine.
Senate Counsel, could you read how we would do that?
Mr. Chairman, members, if there aren't any other questions, thank you
very much. Thank you, Mr.
Thanks, Senator.
Mr. Chair, what we would do is delete everything after services on line 13, and then delete lines 14 and 15, and then the B on line 16, and we just move that all to a section 4 and have that uncodified.
Is okay, Senator Berglund?
Yes.
Senator Berglund moves that amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Berglund, the Commerce Committee has requested to see the bill. Senator Berglund moves Senate File 245 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce. Is there anybody else in the room who wanted to speak to the bill? Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Senator Berglund, Senate File 162.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, last session I had a bill that would have created a moratorium on development of more radiation therapy facilities in Minnesota. And very near the end of the very shortly before the passage of the bill, we'd gotten word from the governor's office that they would not support an outright moratorium. And because of lack of time for proper communication, we went ahead and passed a bill that would have created a sunset on the moratorium. After that, we found out that the governor's office would have supported a longer time before the moratorium would expire, and so that's what the bill does that we have before you today. You know, we have been surveying these facilities. There are two more that have gone online since we've talked about this last, and what we can see that has done is actually reduce the capacity use of all of the facilities that we have in the metropolitan area. And so I believe that the study that was done that would have supported the moratorium is still a valid study today, and that we actually, capacity-wise, do not need any more facilities to be built before the date that's in the bill of August 1st, 2014.
Questions from the committee? Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, we have, as you mentioned in the law, this moratorium extends to. Why wouldn't we just wait till we get to the session to look at the whatever the argument might be then? Why would we want to extend that moratorium in 2009 when we still have two more years to go? Why wouldn't we just be better served to wait and see what happens and then decide?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I have no reason to believe that anything is going to change over that period of time, and I do believe that we should be focusing our energies on other issues.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, then would you not be in favor of having a permanent moratorium? Would that be, I mean, when, I'm just unclear, frankly, about the value of a moratorium, what that does for us in our health care policy and what direction it leads us to. Are we saying that we want to have a permanent moratorium on facilities, and if so, why? And I'm unclear about the policy.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, my original position was that we should have a permanent moratorium that we could evaluate down the road to see whether it needed changing or lifting in some way. In discussions with the governor's office, that isn't an option at the moment. This is the date that they thought would be acceptable, and so this is the date I'm proposing.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, as I understand it, then the policy that you would prefer would be to have a permanent moratorium, but having a temporary moratorium is kind of the best we can get, and so we should keep extending it as best we can until such time as we could get a permanent moratorium. I just wanted to be clear on the policy direction that we're aiming at here. But I do have a question for you more specifically about the bill. We've been given a number of things that say, here's people that don't agree with your bill and say we should oppose it, and I don't see anybody writing a letter in support of your bill, and I'm wondering who does support your bill. Other than I understand that you do, and I'm just saying, are there, I'm not trying to be, you know, flip here, I'm just saying, are there medical organizations that are arguing in favor of your bill, and who might they be?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, we've had a lot of testimony in this committee in previous years about this legislation. So I didn't bring letters or witnesses or testifiers today because I figured most people can recall the conversation well enough. This bill is not a bill that's about stifling innovation. It allows for more and better radiation therapy machines to be installed in Minnesota, and in fact they are being installed in various facilities, and they are improving the length of time that it takes to provide treatment to people. But when you build one of these facilities, it is a multi-million dollar operation, and if we build more of them than we need, we have to pay for more of them than we need, and it does drive up the cost of care per person. And so it is for that reason that I believe this is a good bill, and I think other organizations may be, you know, more representing the idea of the entrepreneurial side of this, since this is a very affluent cost center in the Medicare reimbursement system. But I do not think that that should be our driving purpose. I think our driving purpose should be to serve the people of Minnesota as well as they need at the lowest cost possible.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, the letters I have are from the Chamber of Commerce, which certainly would, I think, speak to your point about competition being related to innovation. But the other letters are from American Cancer Society, the Minnesota Medical Association. And I appreciate your point that we've had hearings on this in the past. Some of us have not been on the committee for a length of time, but can you tell us at all which organizations support the continued moratorium? And with all respect, since we had the discussion last year, and your point is nothing has changed, but it still doesn't, in my mind, build the argument to say we ought to do it again when we're still 2 years away from the expiration of a current moratorium. And I'm just wondering who supports this effort to extend the moratorium right now when we still have 2 years to go.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I believe a number of practitioners and certainly the existing organizations that have facilities that are owned by a variety of different types of providers and organizations. So I could go have someone go to my office and get that list that I've given you in previous years of all the different ownership entities. I think they are looking at the capacity issues that they have at their various facilities, and they, I think, are saying that we don't need any more investment in creation of new facilities at for a number of years into the future, which is what the bill would do.
Senator Hahn, then Senator Lynch.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize to the committee for continuing my questions here, but I did have a couple others that I wanted just to continue the dialogue here, if that's all right. On your chart, Senator Berglund, that you provided to us on the capacity, and I'm trying to understand how to read that. You show capacity in 2007 to be at some, each center has some number, 80%, 90%, 85%, and then the 2008 capacity is less than that in almost every case. But I looked at and I counted the number of accelerators in 2007 versus 2008, and it's really the same number. So how do we read the decline in the capacity? How should we interpret that? What is that attributed to, less demand or less? I'm unclear about, for example, here you have Abbott Northwestern, have two linear accelerators in 2007. They have two in 2008, and their capacity has gone from 90 to 73. I'm trying to understand how to read that and what conclusion we should draw from that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, it has to do with the number of patients that are using the machines. So there are fewer patients using the machines, so their capacity has gone down. I believe that to some extent that is due to greater efficiencies of equipment that has been installed since the last time we looked at this. And to some extent, it is because of other facilities that have opened up since the last time we looked at the survey.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, just a final comment, and I know we've had this issue before. I'm not sure if I understand why we need to extend a moratorium that we have that's in place right now to 2011. But, again, I think that this whole process points to a problem that we should wrestle with, is that what is the ability of a legislative committee to make decisions of this nature when, in most cases, we rely on a marketplace to digest a huge array of very complex information about capacity and pricing and value. And is it really right to say that those kinds of decisions can be made by a few people in a legislative committee and have it become dominated by politics, which is what this is happening? I feel very uncomfortable making a decision, frankly, one way or the other about this. I don't think this is an appropriate thing for the legislature to try to decide. And so I'm going to vote no on the extension of the moratorium. I have not heard a compelling argument here to why we should extend it today, and I don't know that there's been any answers given to the larger questions that we've asked in the past, but there clearly is no argument to say we should extend the moratorium we have today that goes out to 2011 for an additional few years. We've heard nothing to make that case. We've gotten a list of nobody who says we should do that other than the proponent of the bill who's presenting it. And so, Mr. Chairman, I think it is unwise for us to go ahead and do this at this time.
We do have some witnesses who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill, but Senator Lynch and Senator Erickson-Ropes and Senator Gorey have their hands up for questions or comments. If you want to go ahead now. Otherwise, we can take testimony. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, I'm speaking in favor of the bill before us, and I want to be clear, I don't think that there's anything in this legislation that jeopardizes patient care or patient access. I think Senator Hahn is correct in that this is an issue that we will probably continue to wrestle with, but in my eye, this is a very small component of what is a much, much larger problem surrounding medical technology and the medical arms race and best practices. And I hope and believe that those conversations will continue. But in the absence of that very difficult and at times very controversial work, which needs to happen, and we started those conversations, the policy question here has to do largely with cost containment. And so much of our focus is often on access, and this is a piece of the puzzle that speaks to containing those costs. And so I'm pleased to be able to support Senate File 162.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank Senator Lynch for her comments, because mine were very similar. But Senator Hahn, I want to respond to your question about which organizations or who's in support of this bill. And I don't have a list of organizations, but I do recall in past testimonies Senator Berglund has had lists of organizations. But I would answer your question by saying, I don't know if these people are members of organizations, but I know there's tens of thousands of Minnesotans out there who have told us as legislators to get your hands around cost controls in the healthcare sector. They can't afford their health care anymore. It is being treated like a commodity in the market system. And one of our big challenges here is to control costs. And if you have an overcapacity in the system and machines going up across the state, they're not running at 100% capacity or even 90%, it adds additional costs to the system. And those costs are passed along to everyone in the healthcare sector. So I would say there's lots and lots of Minnesotans who would support this bill, because it's an effort to control costs.
And Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, and to thank you, Senator Erickson-Ropes. I guess my comment would be that I think you're right. People expect us to do things that would control costs. I don't see that this does anything to control costs. What we're doing is we're saying that we want a government-controlled monopoly on these services that the legislative committee is going to manage. That is a hugely inefficient model to say we can control costs through that process. That is my point. I don't know what the capacity of the state is for radiation. I don't think anybody in this room knows. I think that's a question that is so complex that I don't think you could get any 10 people in any room and they could make a decision on that with any degree of confidence. And that's why marketplaces work. And so I think for us to say to the people of the state of Minnesota that we've got some legislators in a room and we can make a decision about how many machines to have do certain medical procedures and that that's going to control costs, I don't think there's any evidence to support that contention. So I agree with you that the public expects us to do things that control costs. My argument would be getting it out of the political process and the legislature and into the marketplace is the most effective way to do that, and that's why I think we should oppose the bill. But I appreciate your point.
Senator Lori had something, but maybe he's going to wait until after the testimony. Do you guys want to go now? Okay, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Berglund. I am quite offended by your comments, Senator Hahn, because I do believe that some of us actually took the time to read these reports, and I actually took the time to visit these hospitals and understand how this system actually works. So I don't have a full understanding of cost containment in the healthcare system in this country, but I do understand how these clinics, these hospitals actually work. And I had an opportunity to visit many of these hospitals and take a look at how they provide treatment to patients that are low income. And so I believe that Senator Berglund's intent here is to make sure that all people have access to these treatments and that we have the facilities for people who cannot afford to go to expensive clinics. So I'm in support of your effort, Senator Berglund. I do think that we need to review this. I think the numbers that you brought before us are very clear. Here we have 2007. The capacity in 2008 has gone down. I want to make sure, Senator Hahn, that you do know that we take this very seriously. I take this very seriously. I have reviewed this very carefully, and I have reviewed this report. This is not a political decision for me, but it's more a human decision. It's about the patients and the people that I represent here. It is not a political decision. I just want to leave that on the record.
Senator Coring, and then the testimony.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I hope I can articulate this, and I want to tell the reason why I support this legislation, is hospitals, we have a different situation out when you're out in outstate, like up in Brainerd or Little Falls. The hospital, there's only one hospital to go to. Down here, you have regions, you had St. Joseph's, you have Abbott, you have HCMC. You have a different situation down here. But I will say that oncology units are profitable centers. Now, if somebody nod their head if I'm not right, but oncology is profitable. And what we're wanting to do is make sure that if there is an oncology unit, that it is connected somehow to a hospital. Everything that hospitals provide, emergency room services, everything they do, not everything is profitable. So I don't know that this would happen, but I'll give you a hypothetical, and I don't like hypotheticals, but I'm going to tell you it anyway. Let's just say St. Joseph's Medical Center in Brainerd, when they provide oncology services, let's say some other freestanding clinic comes and plops another oncology unit right four blocks down the street. They're actually taking the profitability away from my hospital, which is going to hurt my community. And I take that very damn seriously, I can tell you that. And so that's why I support this bill, is because you're protecting hospitals is what you're doing in the end of it. That's the simple fact of it. I hope I explained that correctly.
Thank you. We have two witnesses who wish to speak in opposition, Dr. Irv Lerner and Sue Nordberg. Welcome to the committee. And please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Irving Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R. I'm a medical oncologist and have practiced cancer medicine in this community for some 40 years. I'm an adjunct full professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota, and I'm a member of the board of directors of the Midwest Division of the American Cancer Society, and I want to speak against extending this moratorium. My focus, and we've heard it articulated, and I compliment the senator who did articulate it, is the patient and the patient's well-being. My judgment, however, is that however well-intentioned this bill is, it will add to the burden of the cancer patient. Please understand how sick these people are. They are sick from their disease, and sadly, we make them sicker yet with our treatments. And more even than sick, they are frightened. They're frightened of the big C, and on top of all that, we make it difficult for them to get their treatment. Access is a substantial issue, and this bill, I would submit, reduces access. I'd like to give you a couple of quotations from real live patients. I didn't make this up. I am writing this statement to let you know that having access to comprehensive cancer treatment centers that are close to one's home is not just a matter of convenience for a cancer patient. It is a matter of life and death. 10 minutes does make a difference. I am very concerned about prolonging a moratorium. From one patient. A patient who lives in Woodbury and who required radiation therapy treatments and had to travel to Maplewood to receive those treatments wrote this to Senator Berglund. However, I did not like the drive every day from Woodbury to Maplewood, passing by the excellent medical facilities in Woodbury. Cancer is scary in and of itself, and making radiation more accessible seems to me to be in the best interest of the patient. The current moratorium creates another barrier slash burden in illness where there are already many, and I agree with that. That writer, by the way, was the mayor of Woodbury, Mayor William Hargis. And if you think about it, he probably has many advantages over the average cancer patients in terms of ability to travel, access, et cetera. And moreover, he was receiving a form of treatment that we would consider less arduous than the average patient who's receiving radiation therapy, although I doubt very much if he would agree with me about that. So what about the patient who has fewer advantages and who receives a more arduous treatment? We're asking that patient to have a bigger burden yet. The intent of this bill, as we've heard said many times, is to save money. Everybody's interested in reducing health costs, and we applaud that. That's a totally laudable goal, but I would submit to you that the rationale is totally flawed. Please remember that there is no public money expended in the creation of radiation oncology facilities. No tax breaks. It's not a football stadium. There are only two ways that health costs could be increased by the addition of appropriately placed radiation oncology facilities. One is by an increased utilization of the services. Now, I think that's an argument that does hold water in certain aspects of medicine, where there are optional procedures. If a doctor makes a judgment to order an X-ray or a CAT scan or an MR, and perhaps there will be more CAT scans and X-rays and MR if there are more facilities available to those doctors. But I would suggest to you that cancer treatment, whether it's surgery or chemotherapy or radiation, is not optional. It's mandatory. And to suggest that we will order more radiation treatments for patients with cancer because we have more facilities and we have a vested interest in those facilities, I'm sorry, but that rubs us exceedingly ill. It's unfortunate to hear such comments. The second way that we could increase health costs is by increasing the cost of the service. Sure, if you have built a facility, you have to make up your revenue, and so you will simply charge more. But there's no way you can do that because these services are effectively mandated by Medicare. We can't negotiate that. We can't make those prices higher just because we have access to more facilities. You know, in medicine, from day one, we are taught that all of our decisions need to be evidence-based, and we have that locked firmly in our thinking. So where's the evidence here that the addition of appropriately placed radiation facilities adds to health care costs? You have heard no evidence presented. I am unaware of any such evidence, and what's more, I doubt seriously that such evidence exists. The only so-called data in support of this bill was the very comprehensive study presented by Oncology Solutions last year, which determined that each radiation therapy machine is capable of delivering treatments to 35 patients in an 8-hour day. That's the basis of the survey you just saw, too, with respect to capacity. It was based on 35 patients a day. The problem with that so-called data is that, I'm quoting from the study, what appears to be a very comprehensive study, based on Varian, that's the name of the manufacturer of the radiation equipment, statistics which have been adopted for the purposes of this analysis, each traditional linear accelerator has a maximum capacity to treat 36 patients. In the entire study, that is the basis for the statement that 35 or 36 patients a day can be treated by a single machine. Well, the problem with that is that the company Varian disallows that, speaks against that. They say, and I quote, "Treatment methods, setup, and Q&A time all drastically vary overall capacity and patient load. Capacity and throughput are extremely dependent upon the profile of a practice and its patients and the hospital and clinic's workflow processes. They are totally unwilling to stand by 35 patients per day, as well they should be. The governing body in this entire field of radiation therapy is the American College of Radiation Oncology. Their Red Book of Guiding Principles for the Practice of This Science of Medicine states very clearly that an appropriate number of patients to be treated in an 8-hour day by a radiation therapy machine is 28. If you change the denominator from 35 to 28, all of the statistics you've heard become rather pointless. The next speaker is going to elaborate more on why the number of 35 patients per day per machine is inappropriate and sets a legislative standard for an unacceptable quality of medical care to our patients in Minnesota. In fact, in the period of the current moratorium, which extends to 2011, we have the opportunity to carry out, in contrast to the study I just cited you, an impartial and unbiased study of community need as was recommended specifically by the American Cancer Society, hardly an entrepreneurial body. So we hope that you will approach this issue in an open-minded way on behalf of our patients, and we're happy to engage in discussion with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Werner. Ms. Norbert, Sir Berglund?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to insert one comment, and that is that we've used the same standard in both surveys because it would be unfair to be changing the standard, but I might say that there is evidence that would show that we should be reducing the number, increasing the number of treatments per day per machine because of the introduction of the Rapid Arc, which is a better type of machine, much more efficient, which can treat a person in 2 minutes that used to take 15 to 20 minutes. So, but we haven't changed the standard for the purposes of this survey because of the introduction of that machine. We're using the same criteria that we used previously so people can compare from 1 year to the other using the same information.
Ms. Nordberg?
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Susan Nordberg. I have been in healthcare field for over 25 years. 19 of which have been spent directly working in radiation oncology, caring for cancer patients. More importantly, I am the granddaughter, daughter, and friend to those unfortunate enough to bear a cancer diagnosis. As a board-certified radiation therapist and medical dosimetrist, I have been asked to address the moratorium on radiation therapy centers and, in particular, the use of linear accelerators with respect to the number of patients each accelerator can treat per 8-hour day. I have been informed that a recent study by Oncology Solutions states that each linear accelerator can treat 35 patients per 8-hour day, lessening the need for additional centers and machines. I am here today to tell you this statement was true. Between 15 to 20 years ago, in the early 1990s, an era when I began my career in radiation therapy, an era when technology and treatment techniques were not as advanced as they are today. In the modern era of radiation oncology, linear accelerators are equipped with image guidance systems that precisely target the cancer prior to treatment. Respiratory gating and more advanced technologies are also available. all designed to improve the accuracy and precision of the cancer patient's treatment using innovative technology to provide quality radiation treatments. These modern radiation techniques have proven to be highly effective for cancer patients, producing minimal side effects due to the radiation dose conformity and the ability to precisely image and target cancerous tumors, all of which have worked to increase the quality of the life for our cancer patients. However, there is a catch. These techniques and technology require more time. Therefore, today, in the modern era of radiation oncology, the number of radiation therapy treatments per linear accelerator in an 8-hour day is not easily quantified. There are multiple factors that affect the amount of time needed to treat a patient. These factors include patient setup time, actually lying them on the couch and getting them precisely positioned for their treatments, the use of immobilization devices to fine-tune and secure that body part, patient cooperation, are they able to hold still, are they in pain that day, the type of cancer being treated, the treatment modality prescribed by the radiation oncology, which directly correlates to the type of cancer, image guidance techniques used to visualize targeted areas prior to treatment, respiratory gating techniques for tumors that move during respiration, for example, lung, liver, and gastric tumors all move with respiration and are very difficult to treat. The amount of dose delivered per treatment also is a limiting factor. In their evaluation and prescription of quality radiation therapy for cancer patients, radiation oncologists will use different combinations of these factors, leading to patient treatment times that range from 15 to 60 minutes in length. In particular, let's examine the IMRT modality. Intensity modulated radiation therapy has become the standard treatment for both prostate and head and neck cancers and is potentially beneficial in selected patients with other cancers as well. The treatment of patients utilizing an IMRT technique takes additional time as multiple fields are used to target patient tumors while sparing adjacent normal structures. The percentage of patients being treated at an individual facility with IMRT is highly dependent on the types of cancers seen in that facility. Therefore, facilities treating a greater number of prostate and head and neck cancers with IMRT will not be able to treat as many patients in an 8-hour day. Finally, I am here today representing the thousands of Minnesotans who currently have or will be diagnosed with this devastating and life-altering disease. Cancer patients must be allowed to receive timely and accurate care in order to control and prevent the spread of their disease. Radiation therapy is an important modality in the cancer patient's care plan. Today, in this modern era of radiation oncology, how are we to tell our friends, family, and loved ones that we are limiting their access to the care and treatment they so desperately need? I say we cannot. Instead, we must commit to supporting this population of people in their fight against cancer. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nordberg. I've got a question for either witness. Full capacity, 35 patients per day from 8 to 5, and you're saying maybe 28 or something might be more reasonable. Lots of other areas of society, when there's a limit of some equipment, the full capacity might be 24 hours a day. Like I know hockey ice time, high school kids in the middle of the night. I know with MRI machines, I've had an MRI at 6 in the morning. And I'm just curious, if you're worried about a shortage, wouldn't they likely go to two shifts? I mean, is there a reason people can only use this machine only good for 8 hours a day? Or I'm just curious why that's a big issue.
Why don't you start?
Mr. Chairman, I'll take that. We currently, at the facility that I work at, treat roughly 60 to 70 patients per day. We have two linear accelerators, and we have hired the second shift. I have two therapists that work 10:30 to 7 p.m., 10:30 a.m. to 7 p.m., and extend longer when necessary.
So in other words, if capacity was a problem, there'd be other ways than building new ones. Because the other question, I mean, Dr. Lerner, you talked about how people, we should be able to put these as convenient as we can for people, and I just keep notice every year the same one, St. John's Hospital, 1575 Beam Avenue in Maplewood, Maplewood Cancer Center, 1580 Beam Avenue in Maplewood, same zip code, they look like they're across the street from each other. Was that to be convenient, or why was that put up there?
Well, that was a question of unfortunate competition, in that St. John's Hospital decided that they needed a facility despite the fact that there was one across the street already existent. But I would also answer, it's a little tangential, in the Senator's comment about being concerned about hospitals. I share your concern about hospitals, but Minnesota law has already dealt with that issue. New radiation therapy facilities cannot be built freestanding. They must be built in conjunction with hospitals. And that is the experience at United Hospital, which has a total partnership with Minnesota Oncology for its radiation therapy facility. The result of that has been extremely beneficial to the community. It's a very well-run, cost-effective structure, and that's the way it will be going forward into the future.
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Berglund.
Just to refresh the committee's memory, this issue got brought back before us after we established that these facilities may only be built in cooperation with a hospital, because we had hospitals who were starting to think about building freestanding facilities that were not connected to their hospitals but might be near other facilities.
Further discussion from the committee. Is there anybody else in the audience who had to speak to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would move then that Senate File 162 be recommended to pass.
Does this go to any other? On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
With that, this, all our business is complete. This meeting is adjourned.
Early.